Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I propose we resume our board meeting. We cannot see the FESB staff, but okay, they're observing via web. Okay. We are now going to discuss paper 8A on offsetting financial assets and liabilities application guidance. Catherine, please.
Yes, so you're not rid of me just yet today. So in my second presentation today, I'll be kicking off agenda paper series 8, which is the offsetting packet for this meeting. There are four papers within it. The first one is staff recommendations for application guidance to clarify IAS 32 in the light of the board's decisions not to proceed with an amended ED approach. The second one, 8B, is any consequential amendments that would be needed to IAS 32 as a result of the board's decisions on paper 8A. And in this project, and 8C is the disclosures effective date and transition, which is essentially the same paper that a subset of the board discussed in July. And 8D is the offsetting due process paper, which is just gives some background and summarized information on the mandatory, non-mandatory due process steps that have been taken thus far in the project to frame the board's discussion of whether or not they believe they've been sufficient and or to discuss whether re-exposure should take place. So first of those papers will be 8A, which Barbara will discuss in more detail on the draft application guidance.
Okay, thank you. Barbara, go ahead.
Thanks. So good afternoon, everyone. If you could please turn to 8A for the IAS 32 application guidance. And to cover a little bit of what Catherine has said on the background, as you remember in the July joint meeting, while the boards did agree on converged disclosure requirements for offsetting, the boards also decided to move forward with different offsetting requirements under U.S. GAAP and IFRSs. So in the ISB-only meeting in July, the board, the ISB, discussed whether we would move forward with the proposals in the offsetting exposure draft as modified with the staff recommendations, or if we would keep the current offsetting requirements. So while the board tentatively decided to keep IAS 32 requirements, the board also understood from the staff that there was some diversity in practice today in applying these requirements. The staff learned this from our outreach and feedback on the ED. And so the board asked the staff to come back with a paper describing whether or not we needed to address that diversity with application guidance for IAS 32. So this is what, you know, paper 8A does. This discusses some of the diversity and whether we need to address it and how we could address it. AP 8A has a lot of information and a lot of different things to analyze, and we also have appendices that discuss the background on some of these issues and to give the board some information, but we won't be discussing those appendices. However, to focus the discussion on the application guidance for IAS 32, I'd like to ask the board to just keep two things in mind. One of those would be that is your objective for offsetting financial assets, financial liabilities on the statement of financial position, and whether you intended the ED to actually change IAS 32 today. So if we go back to the ED, the objective for offsetting in the ED, the boards had agreed that offsetting is only appropriate if, based on its rights and obligations, an entity has, in effect, a right or obligation for the single net amount, and that the net amount that results from offsetting the financial assets and financial liabilities reflects the entity's future cash flows in settling those transactions. So that's the objective I'd like you to keep in mind. And then I would ask if you, when you have that objective in the ED, just to keep this in mind, based on our past discussions and our feedback and the drafting of the ED, we understood that this objective was not intending to change the application of IAS 32 today. So when we came out with the ED, our understanding was the board did not intend to change IAS 32 today. Rather, in IAS 32, in conjunction with convergence, you were also clarifying some of the requirements in IAS 32 today to clearly state the objectives of offsetting in accordance with the conceptual framework and with IAS 1. So on the basis of that, much of the feedback that we received on the ED is still applicable when we're looking at the IS 32 application guidance, and that is why we keep referring back to the ED in these papers, and I'll keep referring back to the feedback we've received on the ED in some of the discussions and decisions made. So in the beginning of the paper, we discussed four issues related to diversity of four issues in practice, or four issues from the ED today. And we have to analyze whether or not those are actually diversity from IS 32. So the four issues relate to the meaning of the requirement that an entity currently has an enforceable right of set-off that is in IS 32 today, the application of simultaneous settlement criterion that is in IS 32 today, treatment of collateral and margin, and unit of account. In the paper, we'll also discuss where we think that the offsetting requirements and the application guidance should go. And we'll discuss where we think the disclosure requirements should go and also what we'll recommend effective date in transition for application guidance. So the first issue that we talk about in the paper is around the IS 32 requirement today that, in addition to its intention to offset, an entity must currently have a legally enforceable right to set off the recognized amounts. And we found that there is diversity in practice around the definition or the meaning of currently having a legally enforceable right today, but because IS 32 does not give guidance on what this means. But I want to highlight that the order of the wording in this criteria is important. So we're not referring to a currently enforceable right. We're saying the entity currently has an enforceable right today. This is very important when we discuss the application guidance for this criteria, for this requirement. So when we looked at the ED, we saw that the ED further clarified the requirement for offsetting by requiring an entity to have an unconditional right of set-off and a right of set-off that is legally enforceable in all circumstances. And we gave the description in the normal course of business and in bankruptcy, in solvency and default of one of the counterparties. So when we received feedback on this requirement, keeping in mind that we did not think it intended to change IS 32, some saw this requirement still only, they only, sorry, let me back up. Some saw the IS 32 requirement is only requiring a right to be enforceable in the normal course of business. So they thought that the requirement in the ED was changing IS 32 because they did not think that this right should be enforceable in bankruptcy or we should be concerned with that because we're presenting on a going concern basis. So they did not think that this was relevant. However, others did see this as a clarification to IS 32. They think that it would be counterintuitive not to have a right that's also enforceable in bankruptcy, insolvency, et cetera, that in order to have net exposure when you're showing offsetting a financial loss as financial liability, you must have that right at all times. I won't go forever, don't worry. The staff also does not believe that the board's objective would be met by presenting an entity's net exposure unless the entity currently has the right to offset. So today we have a right to offset, and unless the entity can enforce that right in all circumstances, but we mean in all circumstances in the normal course of business, in bankruptcy, default, or insolvency, and insolvency. We also, so the appendix to this paper, AP60, discusses this in a lot more detail, and we brought this, as you know, to other board meetings. The other item that came out of the feedback from that requirement in the ED is whether it's appropriate to require these rights for the reporting entity as well as for its counterparties. Because some do believe that if you consider the reporting entity's bankruptcy, this again violates a going concern issue. But with staff, when we looked at our past guidance and the board's intention, we believe that, and especially IS 31 states, that offsetting would be prohibited if it doesn't reflect the substance of the transaction and if it detracts from the user's ability to understand the transactions and to assess the entity's future cash flows. And we, the staff, do not think the substance of the transaction would be reflected, nor can users assess an entity's future cash flows if we do not include the reporting entity's ability in bankruptcy or insolvency as well as its counterparty. So, after all that, moving on to question one, which can be found on page 13, the staff has recommended two things with respect to this first piece. The staff thinks that currently, and we describe it in the paper, is self-explanatory in terms of currently having a legally enforceable right, meaning a right that is not contingent on a future event. We don't think that further application guidance is needed with respect to this specific piece today. And the second part to this question would be, however, the staff does think that there is some inconsistency in the application of legally enforceable and when it is legally enforceable, meaning if it's legally enforceable only in the course, normal course, or, again, in bankruptcy, insolvency, default, and whether it's both counterparties or just both the entity and the counterparty or just the counterparty. So the staff do recommend application guidance, however, for confirming that the legally enforceable right should be available in all circumstances or in those specific circumstances, and that it needs to be available for both counterparties, including the reporting entity. I don't know if we want to stop there and ask question one before we move on.
And let you catch some breath.
I wanted to talk before someone jumped
shall
in.
Shall we go straight for the vote, or do we want to discuss it first? Philippe. Hold on.
Thank you. Perfectly happy with your suggestions in question 1A. Not convinced at all regarding your analysis for 1B, the entity's solvency. I know that in all our literature, we always consider that the entity will fulfill its obligations and that it is a going concern. We do it for revenue recognition, for insurance, for everything. Here, you take a view that there is an hypothesis under which the entity might become bankrupt, and then if under that hypothesis the offsetting doesn't take place, then it doesn't depict the transaction. I think the substance of the transaction is that the entity is a going concern, that's a given, and that it has the intent to offset, because to enter into this process of offsetting, you must have the intent of net settlement. I don't think it is compatible to say you have the intent and you are going concern, and to put on top of that the hypothesis, but yes, it might be bankrupt. I think it's inconsistent. So I don't agree with, I think we always try to depict the rights and obligations vis-à-vis a third party. And given that the entity is what it is, a going concern. So to bring in this analysis that it might not be a going concern, then the offsetting could not take place is inconsistent with the intent and the general literature.
Oh. No, wait a little. Let's collect some questions. And Pat?
I guess to be succinct, I'm in the opposite camp of Philippe on 1A and 1B. I said no to 1A
each other.
And yes to 1B, both A and B. And I guess I have a question for you, Barbara, or maybe an observation. You made the statement that the board was not intending to change the guidance in IAS 32. I do not agree with that assertion. The board would not have exposed, I think, this document, which in fact does propose change to IAS 32, if it didn't feel that there was a reasonably good basis for doing so. So I think that your characterization of what we were trying to accomplish here is not on point. But going back to the question in 1A, I guess I took exception to the statement in paragraph 40 to say that if a right of setoff was contingent or conditional on a future event, an entity would not currently have a legally enforceable right. I could see that somebody could have a current enforceable right, but yet still be subject to losing that because of some condition that may occur in the future. Okay, so you know, without trying to define or debate whether unconditional means the same thing as currently enforceable, I guess my question for you is, are you proposing or willing to suggest that, in fact, they do mean the same thing, in which case we can end the debate? If you're not, if you're in fact you're saying they mean two different things, then I disagree with your recommendation in 1A, because they send different signals. At a point in time, you know, a balance sheet could, in fact, meet the criterion, and offsetting would be permitted, but, in fact, that right might disappear sometime in the future. What I worry about is sending the signal to the investor that, in fact, it's valid today, but it's going to disappear in the future. So I think there are two different situations, and I would rather make the hurdle higher, okay, so that when offsetting does occur, you don't have to worry about it coming undone later on.
Paul? I guess there's only one other permutation between Philippe and Patrick, and that's where I am. I support both A and B. In other words, I support the staff recommendation. Basically, we have an asset and the liability that meet those definitions under our framework. But what the offsetting does is it says the substance of those two things is you only have a net position. And in order to have the net position, I think it's got to be throughout the duration of the instruments, in other words, including bankruptcy. I don't think it's only for the current moment because it's intent-driven. You know, so you've got to be looking to the future. What is your intent? Strangely, I went back through all our bound volumes.
Strangely?
Yes, because it's not the most exciting thing in the world to do. I went back.
That's what John was asking you, Paul.
I know. Yeah. I'm a accounting geek, but in any event, you go back, you know, 2011, 10, 9, all of them had the word currently until 2003, when that disappears, and going beyond that, there's no currently. And then I went to the basis for conclusions in the 204 version where it appeared, and there's not a mention of for the reasons we inserted currently in the, it was the result of that big improvements project for which all of our standards were changed. And I've asked people, and nobody really remembers. But I think the only logical explanation is the one in paragraph in the staff paper early on that currently it means it's not conditional on a future event. The very paragraph 40, I guess, that you disagree with, I think is the only sensible reason to have a currently. So I favor both A and B.
If you meet the condition today, doesn't mean you meet it in the future.
That's true.
That's what matters.
Barbara, why don't you answer some questions now?
Right? Okay.
The ones that were asked. And then, but we have a second round.
They are associated.
Okay, go ahead then.
No, they are basically. I guess I'm in Philip's camp. I do agree with 1A, but I don't believe it's appropriate for us to add the condition for not going concern situation or being default bankruptcy or insolvency. I have expressed this many times here in this table. And I mostly don't agree because I don't see appropriate to acknowledge a right or, at the end of the day, an asset depending on a future event. And that's what is proposed in 1B. So for netting agreements, for me, what is important is My right during the normal course of business.
Can I have a go? Okay, Ian.
Because it's related as well. 1A, I agree. I've got another permutation for. 1B, I'm with Philippe and Amaro, and the paragraphs 22 to 25 basically spell out the argument. Thanks, Barbara. But the one thing that's got me a little intrigued is the counterparty bankruptcy. Because maybe I agree with that if you can't do offsetting in the case of the counterparty going bankrupt, then maybe you haven't got a right of offset currently even, which is different from the party that's reporting and the going concern worry there.
That's right.
Related to that, I think if the right to offset was not enforceable in bankruptcy, we shouldn't allow it. Because it's a very specific thing that we allow to offset an asset and a liability against each other. If that is not truly enforceable under all circumstances, we should simply not allow it. But Barbara,
if we take a step back, just as a reminder, all the staff has discussed has already been agreed by the board in the ED.
Exactly.
15-0. Sorry, Mara. But so just to remind the board of that.
That will not stop us from changing our mind.
I understand that. That's just one reminder. If we go through, I'll try to go through most of the comments, but I don't know if I will address all of them because I may not. But with respect to the own entity's insolvency or bankruptcy or default, If you have an entity that has a 20 million, say the entity has a 20 million asset and a 19 million liability, and they want to net it to 1 million, But in the event of default, their counterparty is not going to be able to enforce that. So they're still going to owe, their creditor is still going to owe the counterparty $19 million, and they're going to still get $20 million from the counterparty. Does not, in the staff's view, reflect the net exposure of the entity at all times, as well as the substance of the transaction. Remember, offsetting is an exception to recognizing individual assets and liabilities. In order for you to have the net exposure in all circumstances, you have to have it on both sides of the transaction. But I understand you disagree with me, but let me go through the... So that's what the staff thinks. And the staff thinks that the application of ISRE today was not meant to be changed by the ED. We didn't, when we were discussing this with the boards, we understood that the ED was one being issued, obviously, for trying to converge the requirements and also to clarify some of the items in IS-32 to further explain how the boards wanted those applied. So, again, this is why we're coming back around to this. Now, I just want to make sure, again, that it's clear. I'm not saying that the requirement is that it's currently enforceable. Or we're not saying that's what IS-32 is saying. We're saying IS-32 says the entity currently has that right as of its reporting date. Whether or not they can currently enforce it, they may not be able to because maybe they haven't either paid for those, so it hasn't matured. Maybe there isn't any bankruptcy yet. But if there was bankruptcy, they would have been able to enforce it. The rights of the contract today say they can enforce it. We did say in the paper that we don't think that if the enforceability goes away in the future, say if there's a change in taxation or change in ownership, we don't say that we think that should preclude offsetting. Now, maybe that the board would change its mind on that, but we do think that unconditional in that sense would create a higher hurdle than not conditional on a contingent event or not conditional on a future event. So we do think there's a difference, which is why we didn't add any additional application guidance for this currently being existence of the right today. I think I'll leave it at that.
John.
I guess I'm going to have to repeat a lot of things I just heard, but I'm going to repeat them anyway.
That's not necessary.
I agree with staff recommendations. I particularly agree with Hans this time. we may not all.
Okay, keep on saying.
It is counterintuitive. I'm going to offset something that you can't pay me if you go bankrupt. Yeah. That just makes no sense. So I absolutely agree with where the staff came out. But the other part, to me, that's compelling and important, when we were doing the ED and we were making the proposals, what we had concluded was the ED is consistent with what we meant in 32. What we found out, though, in the process of going through the whole thing, trying to understand what was going on, we found out that there was some divergence in practice, and they were taking advantage of some loose wording. So we tightened it up, not because we thought we were changing it. We tightened it up with the idea of, or maybe clarify is a better way of saying it, is this is what we meant all along. And so I agree with both of the staff recommendations. I'll add one little caveat. I wouldn't have agreed with A by itself. I think you got to look at 1A and B together. And I think 1B really, once you say yes to 1B, 1A doesn't matter.
PK.
I think John said the last sentence, which I was trying to make, is that 1A and 1B needs to be looked in totality, not in isolation. Then it helps. I did have to do a mea culpa here, that at the time of drafting of the exposure draft for our change into offsetting for IS-32, I specifically asked the staff, if I have a right today, but the right is expiring in 2 years from now, do I have the right to offset today? And I think it's C-15, if I remember correctly, specifically came because of my example and said, no, you don't have it, because it's not enforceable at all times. I protested and said that doesn't make sense to me, because today I have the right, so I need to offset it today. And if you want to disclose it, you can disclose it, saying that, 2 years later it expires. But today I have the ability to offset, right? So my only comment here is that when you are weaving this implementation guidance / application guidance, if you can clarify this, because the exposure draft kind of created some noise into the system, and it will be very carefully how you word 1A, 1B in explanation, would help, because as such, otherwise, currently had a lot of connotation to it, a lot of confusion to it, and our exposure draft created further confusion.
Yeah.
I'd be careful in how you draft it when you do that, because I don't think we can ignore currently just like that.
And in the board paper, the Appendix A, 6D actually discussed that issue that you described, because we had a lot of feedback on that, and the staff would have recommended actually changing that wording, because we thought if you have a right, not that if it's currently enforceable, but if you have the right, current right today, but in perhaps 2 years, if there's a change in ownership or something, the right goes away, we still thought the ability to offset today, as long as it's legally enforceable, should allow you. You should have the ability today. So we would recommend in the appendix, we would have changed the ED wording.
Yeah. So in summary, please, when you draft it, I think pay attention to those kind of confusion. And I'm sorry I created some of that confusion by inserting, so asking for that example. But that's why I'm a little sensitive. So we just need to be sure.
PK, you never cause confusion, so that cannot possibly have happened. Are we... let me try to see if we have a majority here for a yes on both questions. I think that is the case. And then Ian, there's a serious rift in the leadership of this board.
Look what that put me between.
We'll discuss this over dinner.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go on.
Okay, so the second issue, and I promise I'll go faster now on this.
Please do.
So that was the big issue. The second issue relates to the simultaneous settlement criterion that is in IS 32 and ED. The staff understands that simultaneous settlement had been included as a practical exception to net settlement. So it was intended to capture payments that were essentially equivalent to net settlement. However, when we had outreach and feedback on the ED, we discovered inconsistencies in interpretation in IS 32 today. Some preparers had actually decided or believed that all transactions through clearinghouse were the same as simultaneous settlement. Others, when they followed strict simultaneous settlement and only net when they had at the same moment, had very rare situations of netting. Then there were others that believe that there are settlements through certain central clearing parties that equate to net settlement because, effectively, it's a single settlement process. Once it commences, it cannot be broken. The entity is only exposed to the net amount, and therefore this process is seen as equivalent to net settlement. And the staff also agrees that in doing our research, and these processes are described also in our appendices, if a gross settlement mechanism exists with features that would eliminate credit liquidity risk such that the settlement process is relatively akin to net settlement, these systems should meet the net settlement criterion. And we discussed the factors that we think need to be in those systems in paragraph 75. So our question number 2, which is on page 18, recommends that to clarify the definition of net settlement, we think the boards should include application guidance that will include gross settlement mechanisms with features that would eliminate or result, as long as they have features that eliminate or result in insignificant credit and liquidity risk and under which processing of receivables and payables occur in a single settlement process, these should also be allowed as akin to net settlement. And this is effectively what is happening today. And we think that this is in tune with the board's intention in offsetting.
So we're talking here about mechanisms that are materially simultaneously, without being time completely simultaneous.
These are actually not simultaneous, but they're akin to a single settlement process. So they're akin
to a
settlement,
which... That's why I say materially simultaneous, without being simultaneous.
The staff is not asking the board to define simultaneous settlement in this way. We're saying this came up as a result of simultaneous settlement. And there are mechanisms that are gross mechanisms that are not simultaneous, but they are akin to a net settlement process. And so we would like to add application guidance to this effect.
Paul.
I do support the staff recommendation, but I also remember Christian, former project manager, sitting here and saying these mechanisms can sometimes take 24 hours. These, what do you call them, gross settlement, a single settlement process can take, and you may be at risk during those 24 hours. I think the criteria that you have in paragraph 75 would be useful as part of your guidance. Would you propose to add those in as a part of the guidance?
Yes, we would. We didn't put that in the question, but we think that we would in the drafting.
Doc.
Yes, I appreciate this proposal, and I basically agree with the idea. But I have one concern that in practice there are some banks who are not really offsetting in this case, simultaneous case, new broadened simultaneous case. So if we broaden simultaneous case, then as IS-32 is not permitting it, but it will requiring it to offset, then the banks who are not offsetting currently needs to offset it. So that point I have a concern, because the barber said it must be allowed. Yes, I appreciate that those transactions must be allowed. But if you say, if you meet this criteria, then you have to offset it. Then the banks who are not offsetting currently needs to check their transaction and their mechanism and everything. So it may take time. So probably I do not oppose this proposal, but maybe we have to discuss it transition area. So just I would raise that one.
Can I respond to that, Hans?
Please.
One, I want to clarify again, we're not asking to broaden the definition of simultaneous settlement. This discussion came up as a result of the simultaneous settlement criterion because people will refer to clearinghouses, which is mentioned in our application guidance in IS-32, as meeting simultaneous in some search situations. However, we're saying we think there are other situations that net settlement is occurring other than simultaneous that's akin to net settlement, and these are the mechanisms. So I just want to be clear, this is not a divergence from simultaneous. This is not making simultaneous an additional definition of simultaneous. We're saying there are mechanisms that will are akin to net settlement. The other thing I'd like to say is those entities that we talk to that only net when they have the gross settlement don't necessarily have these mechanisms. These mechanisms that are in place today, I would say the entities that follow them are already netting. So we didn't find entities that would said, oh, wait, we're missing out on netting because of this. We found entities that didn't have these settlement mechanisms. They weren't clearing through, say, a clearinghouse that had this, and they had a couple of gross payments going back and forth that they were able to net, but otherwise there was nothing else happening. So we just found those situations to be very rare, if that makes sense. So I don't think that this would actually, and based on my understanding of our feedback, this is not something that would add to additional work because we think that a lot of entities are doing this today. The opposite might occur. They might have to look at their clearinghouse settlements and make sure that those meet this. And if they don't, they can't offset.
BK?
Like Paul, I agree that the para 75 is a good menu of the things that we need to have. Barbara, help me with one thing, one of the comments you made in your response to talk, that we might have to look at our clearinghouse agreements. I'm just interested in some of the language here, whether auditors or somebody would demand a legal letter for this, because I can see that there is a room for legal letters to creep in here. And I'll be honest with you, if I'm the audit partner, I would insist on a legal letter here. So I just want to be very clear that these conditions are creating a situation for a legal letter. And what is the staff thinking? How does the staff would like? And like I said, as an audit partner, I would ask for it. I would ask for a legal letter here.
Well, I think they would have been doing that today, PK. And if there's inconsistencies within the audit firm, they need to address that. But I would think they would have been asking for legal letters already.
And on this again,
they're going through clearing.
Okay.
Sorry, John. Okay. I'm
Like Paul, I'm in favor of the staff recommendation, but I'm not in favor of the way it's worded. It's a bit along the lines when you say eliminate or result in insignificant credit and liquidity risk. I would be concerned that someone says my counterparty is a triple B or is a triple A or a double A. There's very insignificant risk. So you have to make sure that you get the gist of 75 in without at the same time making it tick the boxes and don't think.
Good point.
Yeah.
John.
Agree with staff recommendation. I don't think we should make an option for simultaneous, given that we don't have an option for anything else. And if we were to do something there, that would open up everything else. And I guess in response to PK's question about the legal letter, do firms, when they charge their client, do they get like a margin on that? It might be good.
Okay, don't need to answer that.
I don't think you pay this one.
I don't think you should. Do I sense broad support for this question? Yes.
Yes.
Another 50-nil resounding victory.
Victory.
Okay.
There are two more.
53.
Okay. There are two more issues in the feedback with, that we wanted to address for potential diversity. These relate to collateral margin and unit of account. So the third issue is about treatment of collateral and margin. The ED specifically prohibited offsetting assets that were pledged as collateral or an asset that's the right to reclaim collateral or an obligation to return collateral and the associated assets and liabilities. IS 32 does not have any wording to this effect. During our outreach and our feedback, we learned that there were often items that may be referred to as collateral or variation margin, but that were meeting the offsetting criteria in IS 32 today, and so preparers were offsetting those. And when in speaking to preparers, we did not note that there were any particular practice concerns or inconsistencies in the treatment of collateral or margin today. The concerns came up with the wording in the ED. This discussion is further elaborated in Appendix C. So the staff's question, number 3, which is on page 20, is basically that because we do not have this wording currently in IS 32 and because we did not identify any practice concerns or inconsistencies arising from IS 32 today, we do not recommend that any application guidance is added to IS 32 with respect to this issue.
Barbara, as I recall from outreach that you and I and Christian did, I think actually along with Patricia, in meeting with representatives of the investment banking community, that in fact there is a clear distinction, legal distinction, between what is considered to be margin that represents bona fide settlement, daily settlement of a derivative transaction, and that which doesn't. It's just simply collateral. And so, in substance, then, if we're accepting kind of a generic description of what collateral is and therefore represents kind of a settlement, we're reinforcing, in substance, defeasance. We're supporting that kind of a principle. And I think this was an area I know that Christian was very keen to ensure that we clarified that there are certain types of collateral that certain parties have the ability to claw back, okay, that don't in fact represent settlement of a liability. And those are the ones that shouldn't be eligible to be taken into consideration for offset. And we're not clarifying that here.
This says you've got to meet the criteria of 32 for offsetting.
Yes, I mean, Pat, I'll let John answer that.
That's very general.
Go ahead.
Did you mention the staff or did John your question?
And the other
I wasn't talking to you, John. I was talking to Barbara.
Barbara, the other part of this is defeasance would qualify for gain or loss recognition, and this would not.
Offsetting is not derecognition. We all agree on that.
Right.
And when we were doing the outreach, all these issues came up because we specifically prohibited variation margin or collateral from being offset. And the descriptions that we learned about in our outreach were for situations where effectively those would be used to set off, in all situations, those were setting off payments that would be due under those transactions that were not, those amounts that were paid in that were called collateral margin were never going to be returned unless there was a fair value change, which we all agree is also not going to, we're not going to be able to address that in offsetting. So we did not find situations where the issue was, we first of all, we're not defining collateral in the ED. We didn't say anything. We just said if there are amounts that are recognized that meet offsetting criteria, you can offset them. And the discussions we had during outreach were that there were certain amounts that met offsetting criteria that they were concerned should be offset that we were prohibiting in the ED.
I guess what I'm saying here is that by being silent on the nature of the underlying collateral, we're allowing potential practice to be quite broad, whereas in fact we probably shouldn't be that way in light of the fact that we know of situations that have come to light where they shouldn't be offset. Now you're saying generally speaking, but you haven't done a study, you haven't analyzed every single circumstance where in fact practice may not have been in accordance with the standard. We have an opportunity here to make it clear what qualifies and what doesn't.
But we didn't, I mean, in our offsetting, we didn't come across situations that were incorrect. I don't recall coming across situations. I mean, when you're looking at
I recall at different assertions by Christian.
Different.
Okay, this is the reason why the issue came up.
The reason I think Christian was referring to is because we were doing a joint project, and there were entities in other jurisdictions that were offsetting collateral today that we did not think was appropriate. But the IFRS preparers, we did not come across in IS 32 today having these issues. If you remember differently, I honestly don't remember that being an issue.
Well, that's the exact point, that across a broad array of jurisdictions,
the interpretation may not be consistent. Other accounting standards. But
so if we have the opportunity to clarify that, why don't we do that?
Well, if they would use our standard, there would not be this unclarity.
Right? The reason we weren't going to clarify is because we didn't think it was an IS 32 issue.
Could be a result. It could result in a change in practice, though, if and when a jurisdiction does adopt, right? Are you shaking your head yes?
That may be something that we could discuss if we do end up having broader adoption.
Why discuss it down the road? Why not fix it now?
Because we don't think that there is anything to fix.
Paul,
I think
we have to move on.
I think your problem is already addressed. In the offsetting section in 32 today, in paragraph 49C, it absolutely prohibits offsetting collateral against another financial asset or liability. It says here, financial or other assets pledged as collateral for non-recourse financial liabilities, it says offsetting is usually inappropriate. So I thought Christian's issue was really the margin. What do you call it?
Variation.
The variation margin, was that collateral or is it something else?
Yeah.
That
yes.
I think we got a pretty tight rule here already.
I don't know if this is the same thing, but
it is. It is. It speaks to it.
Can we support the answer on question three, which is that we do not need additional application guidance?
Okay, no, huh? Huh. Interesting. Okay. Okay. The fourth issue that we had seen during our outreach and feedback was that neither the ED nor IS 32 specified the unit of account to which offsetting should be applied. The staff did note that there is some diversity in practice today. So there are some industries, such as the energy industry, that do offset individual cash flows based on their practices. Others, such as, say, financial institutions, apply the offsetting criteria to entire financial assets and financial liabilities. And again, in our Appendix C, we further discuss this issue in that paper. So the staff does not believe there's a conceptual reason for disallowing offsetting of individual cash flows, and actually we think that that may be a more conceptually correct answer. However, we also understand there are operational issues involved in this, and there could also be technical follow-on ramifications with other standards if we start piercing a unit of account or requiring this. And because offsetting is required, we would have had to determine how to deal with applying this. So if we had added additional wording requiring offsetting individual cash flows but also allowing a practical exception for whole instruments, we would affect it back to what we're having today in practice. So for this reason, on page 25, in question 4, again, we don't recommend that we need any more application guidance related to the unit of account in IS 32. That's just left a speaker on. Does the board agree, or does the board have, if not, what else would the board?
Yeah, I'm staking over to me.
What, how many do we have?
Okay, go on.
Okay, so on page 26, we have question 5. This is related to the location of our offsetting requirements as well as our proposed disclosure that we've already agreed to. There had been some discussions about offsetting going into IFRS 9 or IS 39, but because offsetting does not relate to classification and measurement of financial instruments but rather presentation, the staff believes the requirements and the application guidance should remain in IS 32. And as the disclosures around offsetting relate to financial instruments, the staff believes that those should be placed in IFRS 7. So, sorry, is this related to the other question? Oh, okay. So on page 26, the staff recommends that IS 32 be the place for offsetting and IFRS 7 be the place for disclosures.
Philippe?
Perfectly agreed regarding the disclosures. I think all disclosures on financial instruments should be in IFRS 7. Regarding the placement of the guidance, I think there are two remarks. First, I think IFRS 9 does include some presentation guidance. When we think about fair value through net income or fair value through OCI, I think that is a presentation issue. It's not measurement or recognition, it's presentation. So we have some presentation guidance in IFRS 9 today. First point. Second point, I think we have recently tried to put some order in our literature by having in IFRS 10, 11, 12, all the guidance on control, consolidation, etc. We have taken out of IS 27 everything dealing with consolidation. We have put it in the consolidation package. Here we have a good opportunity to put some order and to regroup in one standard about financial instruments, the disclosures, and everything else regarding financial instruments. And to have in IAS 32 only left the classification as equity or liabilities on the discussion. And we decided this morning not to deal with it now, but maybe in future. So I think we had a good opportunity to place in IFRS 9 all the literature regarding classification, measurement, presentation, offsetting, which is presentation, impairment, hedging, etc. So I would have supported putting all this guidance in IFRS 9, and there are some other reasons which I think would make it useful to have it together with IFRS 9 if we want to have a package on financial instruments to be endorsed as a package. But that's another issue. It's more political than technical.
I guess there's an argument for that, but I guess my concern would be that as staff, we see the nature of these changes here as really clarifying what we thought the board meant for IAS 32 now. So it's, and if we put it into IFRS 9, given the exposure draft we've got out at the moment, it's most likely that that will have a mandatory effective date, pretty likely of only 2015. So we wouldn't see these improvements in place until well into the future when they're really just clarifications of 32. So that was really what tipped my preferences.
I take it. You could make it, you could have an early application date for those who wish to do it. So, but that's not what we want. We want to have mandatory application. And I agree that the effect of putting that in IFRS 9 would be to postpone by 2 years, which may be an overwhelming agreement and could buy my agreement to the proposal, but it wasn't discussed in this paper. So this way.
We discussed it around the effective date, actually, but that's another question.
Any other comments? Can we agree with discussion? All in favor?
Yes. Yes, Pat. Go, Pat.
Go on, man.
Okay, so so it sounds like we're done. I don't know. Well, as you know, then question 6 and 7 relate to the effective date and transition. We would recommend. Okay, I may not even have to ask the question. We recommend retrospective application, and we recommend effective date of 1 January 2013 for okay. these.
Yeah.
That's.
No, it's too late.
No.
Edgar.
I would question whether you can retroactively applicate it. So it's more a factual question. Are we convinced we're not changing anything?
Well, the staff do not think we're changing anything.
Okay.
Barbara, even on the assessment of which counterparty in bankruptcy matters?
The concerns that came out of that were more around what the legal opinions needed to say rather than whether that actually existed.
I would need to go back and get...
There were a few, yes, that's fair enough. They would have to go back if they don't have those already. And I do stand corrected. There were a few jurisdictions that weren't sure that they could get a legal opinion for legally enforceable in bankruptcy and default. But the staff would have been of the opinion that their application of ISR 2 may not have been the way it was originally intended. So...
Doc?
It's the same point as I asked. I'm not 100% sure this is not really changing the current practice because as far as I understand, there are some banks who are not really offsetting the case you described, and whether or not this meets current IS 32 or not, but anyway. So I have a slight fear that if we publish this guidance, there are some banks who may be required to offset. So then, in that case, retrospective application may be the burden. So I'm not sure. I'm just asking you, after your outreach, do you think that is not really the case?
The outreach, well, the reason these came up is because there was diversity in practice. Some of the items that came up out of outreach were more the opposite of what you're describing. So there may have been some offsetting in the interpretation of IS 32 that was, we didn't know necessarily following the board's intent. Again, this goes back to the simultaneous applying to all clearinghouses. We did not think that was the board's intent unless there were mechanisms that were met. There were a few jurisdictions, but very few, that did not ask for a legally enforceable opinion in the event of bankruptcy or default. So they were not applying, they were having more offsetting than may have been allowed under IS 32, but we didn't find the reverse. We didn't find less offsetting. Now, that may not, you know, that still may be a concern, but it was the opposite of what you're describing.
Very quickly, we have finished voting, right? So it, right, so.
Are we?
We're done voting, right?
Yeah.
No, okay, no. I just had a question, sir. Go ahead.
Philippe, I'm not trying to reopen a vote we have made, which I've lost, but I would like that the basis for conclusions regarding this issue of the entity's own bankruptcy would explain, and I hope you can make it, why we decided to conclude in contradiction with what we say in 25B in IS 42, where when it comes to classifying an instrument between liability and equity, where there is a contingent settlement provision, those elements were, we say, only in the event of liquidation, the issuer, do not impact on the classification. So here we have taken a view which is contrary to what we say in 25B. But I would like that we can clarify this contradiction.
Collect all the final answers. No, wait. They go, and then pass.
Now we just discussed the issues on currently. And Pat not agree, and on the future outcome rather than legal right. And now we require retrospective applications. Can I ask for clarifications. Let's assume, you know, there is a legal right 2 years ago, and 2 years ago is within the comparative financial statement. And 2 years later, let's assume this year, and something happened, made it legally enforceable, whether the company need to change the previous assessment or not. This is the question related to what Pat. No.
I wouldn't think your previous assessment would change it for something that happened now.
No hindsight.
Well, you wouldn't have even had a legal enforceable. So you're saying it was legally enforceable 2 years ago, but you didn't know?
The other way around.
It became legally enforceable today.
Yeah,
it was legally enforceable, you thought that, but it has subsequently changed.
Those years, I mean, this goes back to Pat's issue, those years that it was legally enforceable and currently it was offset, and then the years afterwards it wasn't.
So no hindsight. No hindsight. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I guess like Philippe, I don't want to reopen something, but I want to put.
Yes, you do.
No, I'm serious. I want to put an example in front of
lawyers.
Put an example in front of the board that I think is important here. We're saying that the use of currently enforceable is evaluated as a point in time. Let's just say you're an investment bank, and you have $1 trillion of derivative assets and derivative liabilities.
Not to be emotional.
And you are moving down a slippery slope from a credit perspective. You're moving from investment grade to below investment grade. You're in that BBB rating space. Okay. Let's say one of the conditions in these contracts is a rating action. If you move to below investment grade, you lose the right. So let's say at the balance sheet date, you take advantage of the right and you report this position on a net basis. Not 2 years later, but 60 days or 90 days later, okay, you're downgraded, the trigger is exercised, and you no longer have that right. Investors are reading those financial statements. Do you think PK and John's former firm are going to be able to sustain the lawsuit, okay, against them for that kind of presentation?
Things change all the time. In an
Your pension, man. But that's the point. You're sending the wrong signals to investors here. Okay, this happened throughout the crisis with rating triggers and margin calls. So we're ignoring this information, okay, and we're essentially saying at the balance sheet date, as long as it exists, we ignore. Okay. No, but that's you saying if it's currently enforceable. Okay.
We said it's legally.
Are we now going back through?
Sorry. No, I'm just saying that's an example.
You didn't say currently enforceable.
We didn't say currently. You currently have the right. It has to be enforceable throughout the life of the instrument.
That's what we voted on.
That's not the way I'm interpreting this. Essentially, what you're saying is it's unconditional.
Yeah.
Why aren't we willing to use those words then?
We do. This is what you want. And it's there. You won your battle.
Sorry, but I don't understand why we are discussing this now, whereas we've had this discussion.
We didn't add unconditional in. We said it's not contingent on a future event. You're offsetting.
See, I disagree with your interpretation, Paul. I think you're making a flawed decision. That's all. I really do.
We need a legal opinion.
We already made the decision.
Well, that's true. You already made it, but I'm just putting a marker down. That's a risk.
It wasn't something that came up in our outreach that this condition, I mean, I don't, well, okay, I won't, sorry.
I just wanted to make that example.
I think you're okay, Patrick, I really do.
Okay, let's move on to the next.
Did we vote on question seven?
Yes.
We did, okay. Do you have to ask for permission to draft? Or?
Permission granted.
Great. And whether anybody will dissent? So we have how many? Okay.
We can dissent on a non-change of a current standard.
On the basis that you think it is a change.
The next speaker is
Okay. Well, we'll come up to with that when it's there. You know.
We'll discuss it now.
We have to discuss it now. Okay.
Quickly, two things. It violates the framework assumption of going concern. Second, it creates a conflict within IS 32 against 25. I just mentioned that in IS 32, for the classification, when you decide whether it is liability or equity, when there is a contingent settlement provision, you do not take into account the event of liquidation.
This is not a classification issue. If this is an offset, this is
just listen to me 1 minute, please. How do you take into account the event of liquidation? When it comes to classification, you disregard. When it comes to offsetting, you regard it. It's inconsistent.
Beth, did you want to say something?
Yeah, my concern, obviously, revolves around the interpretation of what we were... My concern revolves around the interpretation of what we were just discussing, question one. If in fact, my interpretation is incorrect, that's fine. I want the staff and other board members to illustrate for me why my interpretation is incorrect. And the other issue I have some concern about is unit of account. We have an opportunity to make a clarification. We're choosing not to. We know for sure that certain industries choose the unit of account as cash flows, right? The utility industry, as an example, and other industries choose it at a much higher level. Okay, so question is why aren't we choosing to provide clarification of this issue? And I think, you know, to my mind, it's an opportunity. We've invested over a year in this project. To not take the opportunity to make these clarifications, in my mind, doesn't make sense.
Because the clarifications that the staff would recommend would result in the exact same practice today.
And what would be the recommendation you would make?
That offsetting would be required on a cash flow basis unless there was impractical or operationally burdensome. In that case, you can apply it to the whole financial asset or financial liability.
Then why not make that recommendation?
Because it's exactly what
we're
doing
today. Place and it's then we have to get into a definition of when it's impracticable or what the condition's going to be. So we didn't think the complexity
outweighed the benefit. We thought was inappropriate. We thought the cash flows were the more appropriate. But the full financial instrument is less of a benefit to a lot of entities because if they only have one or two cash flows that match and the rest don't, they can't offset. So we didn't think it was providing more offsetting. We thought we actually restricting offsetting because of the practice today when they can't do it on a cash flow basis. They're not doing incorrect offsetting. They're just restricted in what they can offset.
Okay.
So we didn't think it was going to a negative way of applying it. That's why.
The third issue is the clarification as to the treatment of collateral. What, in fact, constitutes collateral, okay, and what doesn't is something that I think should be clarified. It was raised as an issue in certain jurisdictions. I think you have an opportunity to clarify it here, and you're not.
Yes?
Okay. Thank you. I'm not done yet. You're not shut of me just yet.
Hans, can you?
Yes, please. Catherine, go ahead.
Okay, so in the light of the decisions that we just took, the next paper is on the consequential amendments. We did have some respondents who asked whether or not any consequential amendments would be needed because IS 12 and IS 19 both refer to the IS 32 offsetting criteria. First, in the context of IS 12, they have offsetting criteria for both current and deferred tax liabilities. But what they, in the way that they're written, they don't have the word currently in there. Offsetting is permitted if an entity has a legally enforceable right to set off the amounts. And also they state that these criteria are, quote unquote, similar to IS 32. They don't state that they are the same. And for those reasons, the staff doesn't believe that any consequentials are necessary to IS 12 or IS 19. For that matter, for the same reasons. And if the board has any questions or comments on that, I think now is the time.
I open the floor. Agree?
Yeah.
Unanimous? So,
okay, anybody disagree?
Okay.
All right, well then.
Catherine is extremely disappointed.
I think we can move on to
we're back to
paper 8C, which is Barbara again.
Okay.
We'll get some disagreements.
So paper 8C is around effective date and transition for the disclosures, the proposed disclosures.
So these have nothing to do with 8B?
This has nothing to do with the previous papers in this board meeting. So, again, in the July board meeting, the boards tentatively decided on the converged disclosures to address the needs of users in reviewing offsetting requirements of financial statements. So, although we've discussed the possible IS-32 application guidance in 8A today, we don't think that any amendments that we make to the application guidance in IS-32 would affect the proposed disclosure, so we don't think we need to bring those back. And we also think it's important to move forward with finalizing the converged disclosure requirements in a timely manner so we can address the needs of users. Just as a reminder, also, the staff did discuss these issues at a board meeting or discuss this paper at a board meeting in July, but there was limited board attendance. And because of the importance of these questions, while the members didn't have any opposition to the staff's recommendations, we're bringing this paper again back to this meeting. I also just want to let the board know that this was a joint recommendation. So the FASB staff made these semi-recommendations to the FASB in August, and they agreed with the staff recommendation. So for transition, the feedback that we received on the original disclosures in the ED was that while they met the user's needs, the level of granularity was an operational burden to the preparers. Preparers had requested prospective application and that they were given sufficient transition time to apply the disclosure requirements. But in the July meeting, when we talked about the converged disclosures and changing the disclosures, we reduced the scope and also we reduced the granularity of the disclosures while we still were meeting the user requirements for these disclosures. So because of this, while we understand that there will be perhaps changes to operationality to meet the disclosure requirements, we don't think that retrospective application or an earlier effective date will be as much of an issue for preparers. So the first question is on page 4. Again, that has to do with transition. So the staff is recommending that for comparability and to meet user needs, the board require retrospective application of the revised disclosure requirements for offsetting. So does the board agree with the staff's recommendation? So the other piece of this paper is effective date. Again, when we were going through the ED and feedback on the ED, some of the preparers had also suggested that disclosures have the same effective date of IFRS 9. And we think that the classification and measurement criteria of IFRS 9 would not change the offsetting analysis, so we don't think that it needs to have the same effective date as IFRS 9. Again, we go back to why we did the offsetting project, that users needed increased comparability for offsetting. And so in order for users to benefit from the increased comparability from the disclosures, we think the transition should be as early as possible. And if we align the disclosures with the effective date with other financial instruments projects, we could, in the end, substantially postpone the effective date of the converged disclosures. So our second question, which is on page 5, is that we would recommend that the revised disclosure requirements be effective for annual and interim reporting periods beginning on or after 1 January 2013. Does the staff agree with the?
Does the staff agree?
Does the staff agree with the staff's recommendation? Does the board agree with the staff's recommendations?
All agreed. Yes.
So can we again ask for permission to draft, or if there would be any dissents?
I don't think we'll see dissent here.
Dissent?
No. No dissent.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Okay. So back to Catherine.
Catherine.
So the last paper in this series is 8D, and it's related to the due process steps that we've taken in this project so far. And the staff has not made a recommendation in this paper because the due process is the mandate of the board and not the staff. But we're providing background of what we've done so far just to help the board have this discussion. But just to reiterate what we've been discussing in this session, the staff doesn't believe that we're changing IS-32 today, and the staff believes that all of the changes that we are recommending have been exposed through the ED, and so that's the staff's view of that. Now, the questions to the board, the first one is whether there have been sufficient mandatory and non-mandatory steps. And then after that discussion would be a discussion of whether the board thinks re-exposure is necessary. So with that,
so
I think we can...
The first question is, was the due process followed properly?
Yes.
We are satisfied it was. Yes, I'm out. You don't look very clarifying at the moment, but...
It's maybe because I don't recall. In every single project, are we going to have a paper asking ourselves about the due process?
Yes, okay. Going forward. So.
Yes.
Okay.
Which I think is a very good thing.
Yeah.
So if we answer the first question affirmatively, I think we can answer the second question negatively, in the sense that we don't think that re-exposure is necessary.
I'd like to ask...
Yes, Paul?
We had a joint exposure draft with FASB. I certainly don't think we need to re-expose, but do we know what FASB are doing? Because they've changed their answer quite dramatically different from the joint exposure draft that we had.
Well, what they're doing in the statement of financial position is nothing.
Okay.
They're retaining the current guidance, but they are moving forward with the converged disclosures.
Okay, so they're in the same situation as we are, keeping our existing gap, which was quite different and will remain quite different. Okay,
right.
Thank you.
Tuck?
Yes, I think we followed every single due process. I do not doubt on this point. However, I still think it would be better for us to re-expose, because I have two reasons. One is what we have discussed so far for this project, because this is a big project for a couple of years, and the outcome here we have is quite different. And of course, we know the story behind this, but there might be lots of people who might know, who might not know what's happening. So we need to explain it in public in a proper way. So that's why I think it would be better for us to make a re-exposure. And that's one reason. And the second reason is I'm not confident with the consequence of your implementation guidance. Although I trust Barbara, but but I'm not confident.
That's where you go wrong.
Confident at all, because once we make it as a final guidance and make it enforceable, then if huge confusion arise, we cannot take responsibility for that. So therefore, that's why I rather prefer re-expose it and listen to the constituents' opinion. That is my opinion.
But we are already re-exposing standards that we feel should really not be, it's not necessary to re-expose, but we do it sort of out of goodwill. And now we will be re-exposing existing standards. I mean, where is this going to end if we go on this track? I don't think that would be a wise. I don't think this would be a wise move.
On the first point, I not agree with you. You know, you say it is a long project, big ones. We start with a big ones called derecognition. We stopped that project already, and then we decided to tackle offsetting issue separately. It is a short term and a narrow scope.
Let's vote. Who agrees it should not be re-exposed? 14-1. Okay, well, yes.
So I didn't want to make this comment before. It's a very silly, and I'm sorry of that, but maybe for the next papers. When you go to the appendix and we refer to the summary, I just noticed that in the very first one in the appendix A, we identify Africa, Asia Pacific, international, and then Nordic, North America, South America, and West Europe. Then I go to the user meeting, and it's Asia, Pacific, Europe, International, North America. So I just suggest for the next summaries to bring either Europe together or keep the same tracking, just to facilitate.
Okay, so noted. Well, it seems that
you're
ready. Thank you very much, and let's take a break until 3 o'clock.
Well, not yet. We still have the draft.